This is David Harvey, and you're listening to the Anti-Capitalist Chronicles, a podcast that looks at capitalism through a Marxist lens. This podcast is made possible by Democracy at Work. Welcome to the Anti-Capitalist Chronicles. This week, I want to try and do something which is seemingly a bit complicated, but do it in a way which I hope is going to be simple enough for everybody to grasp. You know, I was always very much impressed by the fact that Einstein, having come up with the formula E equals mc squared, into which you could put almost everything going on in the universe, he was asked about the simplicity of it all. And his response was very interesting. He said, what we should strive to do all of the time is to be as simple as possible, but no simpler. And I've always borne that in mind when giving these talks and also when I'm writing. But my version of it is to say that, look, I try to be as simple as possible without being simplistic. Now, I'm very conscious of the fact that I sometimes fall over into the simplistic camp and I sometimes fall over in the other direction, but it's such a difficult balance to keep. But I'm going to try and keep it today by, in a way, trying to talk through what I think Marx's historical materialism was really all about and how we might actually define how to use it. Now, this is something that Marx himself never wrote out, but one of the things I've found about reading Marx is that he often leaves clues about things in his footnotes. And there's a fantastic footnote, footnote 4 of the chapter on machinery and modern industry in Capital, Volume 1. And this footnote, he takes up his relationship to Darwin and then makes a commentary on it. And I'm going to read it to you because I think that it's worthwhile getting exactly what Marx was about from his own words. Marx wrote this. He said, a critical history of technology would show that how little any of the inventions of the 18th century are of work of a single individual. As yet, he says, such a book does not exist. Darwin had directed attention to the history of natural technology, i.e., the formation of the organs of plants and animals, which were as the instruments of production for continuing their life. Does not the history of the productive organs of man in society, of organs that are the basis of particular organization of society, deserve equal attention? And would not such a history be easier to compile, since, as Vico says, human history differs from natural history in that we have made the former but not the latter? But he then adds a coda to this. He says, technology reveals the active relations of man to nature, the direct process of the production of his life, and thereby it also lays bare the process of the production of the social relations of his life and of the mental conceptions that flow from those relations. Now, I used to teach this and just sort of go over it and say, well, that's something interesting going on there. But as things went on, I found myself actually spending a whole session just on the meaning of that those little passages. And the last part really defines five, or if you want to divide it up a little bit, six different aspects of a social order. The first aspect is technology. The second aspect is the relation to nature. The third aspect is the form of production of his life. And you could divide that into two. One is the labor process of production, and the second would be the reproduction of labor power. So you could call that two if you want, or just one. So the reproduction of life. Then there is the whole kind of question of mental conceptions of the world.
and how these mental conceptions work. And then finally, in that section, social relations of class, gender, and all the rest of it. So you have these six elements. And if you read back in Capital, you find there's a seventh element there, which is the whole kind of structure of administration and law and the state and the like, which become very important in defining what is a market and how a market works, and become very important in defining the functions and operations of money. So what I would do then is to say, let's look at these five relations, six relations, if you like, and then talk about how they merge together. Now, in earlier sessions, I did talk a bit about the notion of totality. And so I want to think here of totality of a capitalist social order. And that totality is made up of these, let's call them seven distinctive moments or activity spheres or elements or whatever else you want to call it, which actually make up the whole. In the same way that a human body has many functions going on inside of it, so society has many functions going on inside of it. And technology, relation to nature, social relations, production structures, and mental conceptions of the world and administrative and social structures, all of those elements are part of the totality of what a capitalist society is about. So that is the, if you like, the simplification which we're going to make about historical materialism. Now, notice something here about this, the language. When Marx says technology reveals, and in other translations, it's discloses, and in the rest of the passage here, it's lays bare. He doesn't say technology determines. He says technology lays bare, technology reveals. And what he's suggesting by this is that if you start by looking at technology, and you just start really analyzing technology very carefully in all of its aspects, you very soon find yourself talking about all sorts of other elements. For instance, the relation to nature. Technology defines something about the labor process. It defines our conceptualization of the natural world, what we can use it for and what we shouldn't use it for. So the relation to nature then and technology are closely bound together. And then you can go to one step further and say, well, when people started to develop certain technologies, it changed ideas about the world. Consider, for example, what happened when people started to come up with telescopes and microscopes. They started to see things about the world which completely changed their ideas as to what constituted the world. And of course, when microscopes came in, you could start to look at germs and bacteria and things like that, and you could start to look at disease in a different kind of way. So the technology, if you like, redefines how we see the world, and the same applies, of course, with telescopes. We start to see things in a completely different way. And there's a famous kind of passage when that first image came up of the Earth from outer space, when people started to realize that the Earth was a planet floating out in space, and the whole kind of question of the health of planet Earth, and this came about in the late 1960s with the Apollo mission photograph, that the health of planet Earth was something that needed to be cared for. So the technology reveals and discloses. And I think that what this then says is that if I started with something else and started to look at social relations, for example, or I started to look at production processes, I would be very soon into, okay, what kind of social relations are compatible with these production processes? And we would see immediately, for example, that when you shifted from skilled labor of the manufacturing period, the skilled carpenter, for example, is a very different kind of persona from the person who simply minds the machine in the cotton factory. And that different persona is something that arises out of the new technology, which is, of course, mass production in the cotton industry. So this is something that, which is just a very interesting way to do that. You can start with any one of those elements. And if you expand it, you very soon see that element is embedded with, coexists with, co-evolves with all of the other elements. So this is, if you like, one of the things that's important in Marx's concept of historical materialism, that we need to look at the interaction which is going on between many of these different elements. Radical changes in one element are likely to sort of permeate throughout all of the other elements and end up with having big impacts. And therefore, this whole system is evolving also. Marx talks about the way in which systems are becoming. They're changing. They're changing over time. And they're changing over time because each one of these elements, while it's connected to all of the others, is not stationary and is not static. The relation to nature is constantly changing. You know, hurricanes come along, new diseases come along and so on. So it's not as if any one of them is static. Social relations are constantly changing. So all of them are in constant motion, but they're all impinging upon each other, both, if you like, encouraged by, but also constrained by relationships with the other elements. So that this is the way in which Marx understands his historical materialism, which is to say, historical materialism is about a study of society. And you have to look at society as being made up of these different elements. Now, you could add elements. I'm choosing the seven that Marx used, but you could add some other elements to it if you want. But the point is just to say, well, this is the way in which we're going to look at society, and we look at the relations between the different elements at the same time as we see all of these elements are in motion. Technology is constantly changing. Social relations are constantly changing. Mental conceptions of the world are constantly changing. The relations of nature is constantly changing. Yet at the same time, it starts to change, but it can't go any further because it's limited by mental conceptions. That's the kind of argument which Marx is beginning to make. Now, the interesting thing here is that if you start to look at social theory, you'll frequently find social theories laid out as if one of these seven elements is the leading element and everything else sort of falls to one side. For example, if you read the works of Jared Diamond or Jeffrey Sachs, they are very much about the relation to nature. They're environmental determinists. They're kind of saying, basically, the real forces making for historical change in a society have to do with environmental changes. They are the elements which introduce into the situation new configurations, and all the other features of society have to adapt to the environmental changes. So that Jared Diamond, for example, in his environmental determinism and his work is very much making a lot of that. In a sense, the relation to nature is kind of the silver bullet that explains everything. Now, within Marxism, there is a long tradition of saying technology, productive forces are actually in the lead. So you will find a lot of Marxists taking that position. Jerry Cohen in Karl Marx, A Theory of History, basically says, you know, the leading thing is productive forces. Everything else depends upon that. So he is, in a sense, what we would call a technological determinist. And there are bourgeois versions of this. If you read somebody like Thomas Friedman's book on the flat Earth, you'll find him talking very much about, you know, changes in technology, and the changes in technology are essentially dictating to the whole of society everything else which goes on. So that from their point of view, the silver bullet is the technological dynamism, the technological change. Now, there are other people who kind of pick up on other elements. For example, social relations are absolutely crucial, that you want to actually deal with it. And you will find anarchists saying, for example, that the real changes have to be the move towards a non-hierarchical set of social relations. And there are some feminists who will also say that patriarchy is the problem, and that therefore the abolition of patriarchy, abolish that, and everything else in society will go fine. The anarchists say abolish all the forms of hierarchy in social affairs and social relations, and everything will go fine. So again, the silver bullet is the nature of the social relations. And then then there are other people, for instance, who will talk about how the dynamics of daily life actually end up creating new situations for people. And it's out of that that we start to find social changes occurring through the world. So in a sense, social change sort of seeps up from daily life in all over the place. And there are lots of community movements around the world that are beginning to redefine how production shall occur and so on, so that somebody like Paul Hawken, it's the politics and prospects of daily life which are the silver bullet. Now, I don't think that is the right way to look at it. I think that what Marx is doing is saying, you know, you have to look at a whole lot in relation to each other, which does not mean that in particular historical moments that one or other of these elements, you know, gets out front and starts to pull all of the other elements along the side until it is constrained and pulled back by mere movement in one of the others. For example, what we see right now is the relation to nature has become extremely problematic, and in a way that was not the case when Marx was writing. So that things like the climate change are very much constraining many of the things which are going on in society, and that we really need to start to take very carefully into account the fact that all of these floods, I mean, the third of Pakistan being flooded out, the Colorado River and the Yangtze River drying up eventually. These are the kinds of phenomena we're looking at. And so we're kind of saying there's something going on in terms of the relation to nature, which needs to be taken care of, and it has to be taken care of by societal adaptation to this new situation. Now, here's the interesting point. It politically, at that point, you say to yourself, okay, what kinds of changes would we require to deal with the climate change problem? And you kind of go, actually, at this point, it's interesting to go around those seven elements and ask which one of those is important and what kinds of changes would be needed. What kinds of changes would be needed in production processes, for example, to solve the climate change problem? Well, industrial capitalism is the center of it, and agrarian agricultural capitalism is at the center of a lot of this, and there has to be radical reconfigurations of the way in which industrial capitalism and agricultural capitalism is working, because it's only in that way that the production system will be, if you like, in accordance with the requirement that the climate change problem is going to be addressed. But it wouldn't be in itself sufficient. Actually, so you would then say, okay, what kind of? And somebody said to me the other day when I was talking about this, you are imagining there's going to be a great change of heart, great change of mind on the part of the population to address with that. And I'm kind of going, yeah, mental conceptions have to change. But if you think that mental conceptions are just going to do it all, and that therefore all we have to do is to have everybody agree mentally that climate change is an issue that needs to be dealt with. So, but nevertheless, there are changes in mental conceptions that are required. Technologies. There's a great emphasis right now. The solution is technological. Well, I don't think the solution is technological, but there's no question that the technological moment is terribly important, and it's terribly important to mobilize it, if you like, in the cause of this dealing with climate change. So, but then you find also. That it's not only the technology, but that what we need to do is to change social relations. That indeed, social relations need to shift. That it's unlikely that a world which is dominated by an oligarchy that is largely organizing the world to preserve its own privileges and power. It's very unlikely that social relation is going to be able to address. The climate change problem. That what we're going to need is to actually allow for the fact that initially, when climate change was set up as a problem, it was largely a kind of an elite scientific group that were talking about it. But now people are recognizing that it's at the grassroots, that a lot of poor people are suffering from climate change, and therefore we need to really change the politics of the social relations if we are going to find some answer to the climate change problem. And then there is the administrative and legal and social structure. Now, one of the things I find fascinating right now is if you ask the question, What kind of administrative structure, what kind of interstate system would be able to solve the climate change problem? Well, clearly, the interstate system, as it's currently constructed, with a lot of competition going on between individual states and then huge competition going on between power blocks, you're not going to get that administrative and state structure organized in a way. So in many ways, I would argue that one of the biggest barriers to dealing with climate change right now is the interstate structure, the interstate system. I mean, supposedly the United Nations is supposed to take care of all this, but all you get from the United Nations is a lot of hot air and no possibility and power to do anything. So what you have then is if you ask the question, how will we deal with climate change? It's not simply a matter of, well, you can deal with it in isolation. You have to deal with it by taking care of all of these other elements. And each one of the elements has to be, if you like, shift and be realigned around this idea that, well, somehow or other, we are going to change the way in which we use the environment and change it in such a way that the question of climate change is dealt with, managed properly. So this is, if you like, the way in which I think Marxist historical materialism is working. It would say, you want to find an answer to this question of climate change, you want to be able to better manage it, well, you've got to start thinking about dismantling the interstate system or somehow or other superseding the interstate system so that this kind of competition between states and the competition between power blocks is somehow or other submerged in a greater drive to deal with the world. It has to be also such that the power structures in society are no longer disoriented towards that of an oligarchy and that of an autarky. It's going to be a different kind of world. So what this would say is, okay, let's all agree that climate change is a priority. What do we need to change in order to get it? And do we need to change our mental conceptions? Answer, yes. But what into exactly? Big debate. We need to change our social relations. Yes, indeed, we do. But what into? Big debate. A very interesting kind of question. We need to change our production apparatus. Yes, indeed. We need to change our technologies. Yes, indeed. We need to change all of these elements. So the theory of historical materialism would say, historically, capital has evolved through an interaction between these seven elements. And as I say, I'm just choosing seven because that's a good number to work with. These seven elements have been working together. So if we want to look back historically, we'll look at the way of which all of those elements have been working together. And if we want to look to some way of managing the current dilemmas, then we have to look to how to change all of the elements and how to get a kind of political process in motion. So this part starts to change a little bit in such a way that part is facilitated to change, which allows that part to change. So that this is, if you like, or the sort of politics that comes out of Marxist historical materialism. Now, finally, on this, it's interesting to look at those societies that sought radical change. Consider the history of the Soviet Union. One of the things that happened in 1917 was a lot of elements of this configuration that I'm talking about started to change. And they started to change in ways where you had very innovative things going on in the sphere of cultural production. Ideas, new ideas were coming about. Everything was going, you know, in a more complicated kind of way. And so in those early years of constructivism and so on in the Soviet Union, we see a revolutionary movement in which there was some movement in all of the elements, and it was obviously messy and very difficult. But along came Stalin in 1928, and he put an end to all of that speculative activity, and said basically, there's only one thing that matters, and that one thing is the productive forces. That is, he went with G.A. Cohen and the long line of thinking in Marxism, which is to say the productive forces are at the root of historical change. And Stalin basically said, just get the productive forces working, get them working in a better kind of way, revolutionize the productive forces, and everything else will fall into line. That is, it was a single bullet. theory the creation of socialism. And you'll find elements of this also in the history of Maoism too, a single bullet kind of thing. And at a certain point, Mao, of course, looked at the situation and said, look, the social relations are really screwed up in China. We need to do something about this. And he sought to change it through the Cultural Revolution, which is in a sense saying our mental conceptions of the world have to change dramatically through the Cultural Revolution. And so I think it's very interesting to look at the history of the attempts to change society in some way and then ask what were construed to be the silver bullets and why did those silver bullets create dilemmas. And I think one of the failures of, for instance, the Soviet Revolution, particularly under Stalin, was this idea that somehow or other everything, the only thing that really mattered was mobilize the productive forces, get the new technologies. And so the model of a revolutionary change there paid no mind whatsoever to cultural beliefs, paid no mind very much to questions of social relations in this very general sense, and paid no mind to the qualities of daily life. And so you can kind of say that in a sense, a socialist project should have in mind, well, we have to think about the dynamics of relations. And the dynamics of the relations are such that the kinds of relations that exist between these different elements that I'm looking at, these elements are going to be brought together in a different way. Now, I'm not going to argue that I know exactly, you know, what the elements should do. I'm just posing the questions and just trying to sketch in a way of thinking that kind of says, well, when we start to look at what is going on around us right now, and we start to think, well, okay, what are the dominant ideas? What are the dominant mental conceptions? Where do they come from? How are they changing? What's going on? What's the kind of what's being contested in the field of social relations? It's a complicated problem, but I think that Marx's answer to the question of how do we go about dissecting it, how do we go about using it, how do we go about thinking about the transformations of society and the whole history of capital accumulation and what it's been about and what it might be about in the future, all of those elements can be actually put together in a way. So again, I hope that by laying this out in as simple a way as I possibly can, I'm not being too simplistic, and I hope at the same time that one can start to think about all of these relations in much more serious way. And I would add one other thing, which is Marx sees these relationships existing within this totality, dialectically and relationally. And it's interesting that invariably the silver bullet people have a mechanical view. And they actually end up with a kind of positivist science. And therefore, you find somebody like G.A. Cohen in his Karl Marx, A Theory of History, basically debunking dialectics and saying dialectics is nonsense. It's not analytic. It has no truth value to it. And so, you know, I used to teach with Cohen when I was in Oxford, and we used to have some really fierce arguments about this. Whenever I mentioned dialectical motion and dialectical method, he would scream and say, that's nonsense. It's bullshit Marxism, he would say, bullshit Marxism. And I think that there's still a kind of real question as to how we interpret Marx. Do we interpret it through the positivist analytical philosophical lens, or do we translate it through the dialectical lens? And I'll have something more to say about that in the next session.
Thank you for joining me today. You've been listening to David Harvey's Anti-Capitalist Chronicles, a Democracy at Work production. A special thank you to the wonderful Patreon community for supporting this project.